Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman. With the first quarter of 2021 coming to a close, we've invited New Frontier Data's longtime friend and investor to return to the show to weigh in. Mitch Baruchowicz is the founder and managing partner of Merida Capital Partners, arguably one of the most prolific investors in the global cannabis industry. Mitch, thank you so much for joining us today and welcome back to Canna Week.
It is my absolute pleasure and I can't be more excited to be joined by Giada. We've never done one before together.
It's been a little too long for sure. We were overdue.
Sure.
And so as if one cannabis trailblazer was not exciting enough, it's my honor to introduce our second guest for today's episode, New Frontier Data's very own founder and executive chair, the one, the only Giada De Carcer. Giada, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Always delighted to be here. And as Mitch said, even more so with Dan Baruchowicz, as I like
with
to
call. Limited bandwidth from Italy.
So to dive right in, I know that you both recently participated in the Cannabis Mexico Summit. So before we get into the industry outlook for the United States, we wanted to get your perspectives on a recent New York Times article, which reported that more than 2 years after the Mexican Supreme Court ruled that the country's ban on recreational marijuana was unconstitutional, lawmakers have approved a bill to legalize recreational marijuana. So medicinal cannabis was legalized in Mexico more than 3 years ago. Mitch, why do you think it took so long to pass the adult use legislation?
Well, I think you started with you buried the lead in some ways. While the Supreme Court legislated that the ban was unconstitutional, that doesn't mean that there's a way to regulate it. And I think John Cagia, actually, you know, New Frontier's own, actually made a great point several Canna Weeks ago that I did with him when he said, it's not just enough to decriminalize, you actually have to have a way to regulate or legislate it the right way. And I think given the Mexican, there's some unique cultural aspects of the Mexican populace that are worth noting that I actually noted at the Mexico summit. So to be a little bit duplicative, there's not a wide majority of people in favor in Mexico of legalization right this second. And I think advocates and the regulatory underpinnings of this new effort really deserve a tremendous amount of credit for navigating those headwinds and also moving forward when the popularity is not, it's negligible for adult use while medical is very popular. And I think while medical is preferred in Mexico, it took 3 years for them to get the comfort level of the Mexican regulators to a certain level where they could feel comfortable passing a regulatory regime to passing the rules that they might have lab testing. Think of how much infrastructure has to go to a country, right? This isn't like the United States where you're passing local laboratories each state. This is an entire federal regime, the largest country to ever take this on, much larger than Canada from a population perspective, almost three times the size. And it's a state, and it's a place that isn't necessarily known for the type of illicit market you might find in the United States or Canada, which I'm going to use loosely as a benign illicit market. Mexico's illicit market is much more challenging because of their historical challenges with organized crime. And so I think a lot of that comes together to create a huge headwind that regulators and advocates and the like who pushed this forward really navigate it and they deserve a lot of credit. Remember though, the one thing I'll say about the case in 2018, which is important to notice, is that it was someone who had epilepsy. So even though they ruled that the ban on all illegality was unconstitutional, it was driven originally by a medical use case. So it's worth noting that.
First of all, the interesting that it is again a medical case, it was a catalyst. It seemed that it often is the case on a worldwide basis. We've seen that quite a few times. But I did want to add another to agreeing with all that Mitch said and very well said. An element that I think is worth adding is Mexico is the Mexican population is a very religious population. And so there continues to be a relatively strong stigma around the plant. So there is that organized crime element, but there is also just a general stigma associated with religion, whereby the general population looks at the plant as something that is just, well.
I think Pope Francis, he actually came out with a mandate that said that it's okay to use for medical, but that adult use is still kind of, I don't think he used the word immoral. I don't remember reading the translation directly, but that's driven a lot of Mexico's, but they still gotten up to like 40%, which deserves a tremendous amount of credit.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's happened, although there's a lot of effort in educating the general population about its medicinal value, and it may also be why it's taken so long, because it literally, the information had to get to everyone. Also, let's remember that Mexico has, in terms of, you know, the economic health of the population, there's a big divide in levels of education. And so getting that information to as many people as possible, again, credit to, you know, the government and the country to really push that effort. There are 127 million people in Mexico. So,
yeah, and given that size, so Mexico would represent the largest cannabis market in the world by population. So, Mitch, given that size, what do you expect in terms of international interest and investment in Mexico?
Well, I think it's going to be phenomenal. I do think there's some cautionary tales. I found the Mexican summit to be really enlightening in that there's a lot of people who are cautious about the overhype that we saw in certain markets like Canada or Colombia. I thought it was kind of interesting to watch all of these professional advisors in Mexico already talking about the scaffolding that the market needs and how we don't want to replicate the mistakes of Colombia, which got overheated. And I thought that drawing the contrast to the Colombian market was quite interesting because most of the Colombian interest is about export, not necessarily home consumption, or by home, I mean domestic consumption. And I did think, I think investment is going to be really interesting for a few reasons. I think there's four really highlights that maybe we should all be focusing on from the opportunity set. And obviously Giada studies this like I do, so I'd love to hear her thoughts. But so the four things I think are interesting is, number one, when you have a federal regime, this is much different than the United States, which has sort of regional biases driving their laws, right? Not every state has the legality, and some states are now only legalizing for medical use, very rarely the case in South Dakota where you do both. So the fact that you go from kind of 0 to 60, although there was a medical regime in place, it was very lightly used in Mexico. It was kind of frowned upon. And even CBD, one of our companies has a contract for CBD, not an easy market to penetrate. So it's interesting that there's going to be a cultivation registry, which will allow standards-based regulation, which I think is great for regulators to get educated and to help grow the industry with that. You know, whether it's quality control or supply chain sort of good manufacturing practices, GMP, GAP, that kind of stuff. I think it's interesting that there's going to be a patient registry and a doctor's registry, which allows, again, standardization and a true medical regime, which, remember, the Mexican patient themselves have not had a great program to really build off of. Because if you don't have scale, you're not going to get products that are cost effective. And I think it's going to be interesting that medicine is going to be sold side by side in pharmacies next to opioids or other medicine. So the Mexican patient is going to have alternatives. They're going to have access to those alternatives. Again, not the same way as the United States, much more beneficial down there for now. I think they'll have access to capital and banks and professional providers. The Mexican Cannabis Summit was amazing for showing how engaged professional providers are. It's not like the New York lawyer in 2015 who told me he couldn't represent me because the Bar Association hadn't opined on the ethics around it, which is nuts, but it happened. And then the fact that the Supreme Court ruled for this in 2018 shows you that it's not just one segment of the regulatory infrastructure that's behind this. It's actually, you know, because someone could have challenged this in court. The fact that the Supreme Court already ruled on it means that you're actually going to get a pretty broad-based consensus at the, let's call it at the upper echelon of the elite political base of Mexico. So I think when you get everyone aligned, you know, the United States or other countries, even Canada for that matter, Health Canada is still moving very slow on certain form factors and other things because there's really pockets of people who don't support it. And I think in Mexico, what you're noticing is at the top levels, because the popular, as Giada said, the popular consensus isn't there yet. It's one of the few countries you may find where popular consensus is not what's driving the legality, which I think is a very unique thing. And I think that shows that, you know, there's like the Mark Andreessen famous thing, which says, if you have 1,000 fans, you have a business. you know, I think there's a huge passionate base of people in Mexico to the point where they built right in front of the Senate building in that square. There's a huge marijuana farm growing. And I've seen great pictures about someone doing yoga. Again, I asked all the Mexican people on the summit to send me some great pictures that I could post on Twitter. It's incredible. There is a huge marijuana farm literally in front of the Senate building in Mexico, which shows that there's the passionate advocates who are going to make sure that this program gets launched correctly. And then there are people, obviously, if they're already engaged with people like New Frontier, they're using data. They're already thinking about this. And I think that's a huge advantage when you have that federal consensus from day one.
Agreed. Something that I found, something that's interesting also about Mexico, I mean, they've had the advantage of looking at all these other nations and to study it and see how they've done it, right? They looked at Uruguay, they looked at Colombia, they looked at Canada, they're looking at what they're doing here. So they have the advantage of sort of having learned by best practices, but also the mistakes of others. And when you look at how they really, when they did a deep dive into truly understanding how Colombia and Uruguay were doing it, given that they're other two more mature Latin American nations, I mean, you can see that they're, you know, they're, as Mitch said, this may not be driven by populist demand. There are other drivers. And when you look at Uruguay, Uruguay is trying to position itself as sort of that trade gateway, right? Like looking to export and become like a big trading center. Colombia would like to become a hub of cultivation, again, with an export sort of agenda. Mexico's geoposition makes it, and its trading history with the United States, which continues to be the epicenter of consumption worldwide, makes it that a commercial driver, a sort of a revenue generating driver, is one that is truly important in Mexico. So I think it's really a matter of dollar sign. I mean, today the value of the annual demand is about $3.2 billion. That could explode if you expand beyond consumption in Mexico and you start thinking about what could happen across borders.
That's actually a great point. And it just made me think of something that I think I brought up on the summit, which I just kind of glossed over. But also the fact that because you have this federal support from day one, you're more likely to get some type of rational exportation law and importing for that matter. So I think in Mexico, you know, you're not just going to get big. It's not going to be like big ag. You're going to get big ag might look at the export markets, right? Cheap, large, high volume, biomass, et cetera. And then on the other side, you might get more of a craft sort of patient focused, consumer focused. The other thing also, you know, we don't even ever talk about, but I know Giada that you and I have spoken about for the last 5 years, hemp. I mean,
I was waiting for you to bring it up.
Mexico industrial hemp. It's kind of mind boggling me. I don't want to do it because I save it for Twitter users, but hempcrete, y'all, it's like, that's my famous saying. It's Mexico is a tremendous exporter of net physical goods like lumber. And I think the fact that they can now have an industrial base, the climate is probably not optimal in certain places for hemp, but Mexico is an optimal place to, for the, you know, if you can create hempcrete rather than concrete, just reducing the weight of the shipping means you're going to get better Mexican housing, better insulation. I mean, it really can change on a lot of ways. And one of the things I really am passionate about in the summit is the fact that Mexico, you're going to see a lot of disruption and also really positive results on the medical side, on the industrial side. Whenever you can reduce cost in a place like Mexico, where COGS really matter to quality of life and those type of elements, you really, these laws really do change, you know, the way society can function in some ways. And that's like really, for me, that's, wow. It's, you know, you can do well, do good. It's really exciting. And it's kind of like heartwarming to think of how many changes you can see in Mexican society from this.
Mitch, do you think that when you look, I'm thinking out loud here. When you look at the timing, right? So they paused for 2 years, in terms of the United States was under a different administration. Do you think there was potentially some thinking around pushing it for now in April under this new current administration, given that there had been sort of friction, right? And some challenges in terms of the two countries trading, and now they may be further opening. Do you think that may have been one of the layers in terms of the thinking behind what's happening now?
Well, no, actually, so one of the timing, maybe this wasn't entirely clear. You'd have to like dig pretty deep to get back and you work backwards. The actual court case gave them a ticking clock to pass the law.
I know.
Right. April. So, but yes, you mean why they picked that April? Is that what you're kind of asking?
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about this. I think it's driven by a few factors. I think number one, the Supreme Court wanted to create enough time to create a regime. But if you push it too far out, then it can almost be too esoteric and you won't get the buy-in. So I think that's one element. I think the second element that, you know, I've been noodling over because I think I've been thinking of writing something on Mexico for a while because I've been intrigued by the fact that it's such a big market and they can solve a lot of their domestic problems by potentially legalizing there. You know, I think they want to get in front of a U.S. legalization for a few reasons. Number one,
That's what I was getting at.
I thought about the game theory around it is kind of intriguing. And we, you know, one thing I do is I do make predictions. You know, obviously I predicted someone was going to go to Europe in the United States in my last one. So I was ahead of that one on Curaleaf. But I try not to make predictions on timing of regulations because I think who knows, you know, there's a lot of motivating factors that are hard to predict. But I do think when you speculate about why April, I think it was important for Mexico to get in front of the U.S. because they didn't want, if the U.S. goes legal and you have people going to Canada, you know, there's a lot of transfer of people to California, Texas, et cetera, et cetera. And if you had a U.S. legalization, I think Mexico might have been concerned that they would have been forced to adopt a lot of what the U.S. did, which may not work for them, right? So because the U.S. It employs a very unique system that states are legal. Remember, I've made this point a million times. It's not the legalization that matters. It's the normalization. And I think because the United States already has a functioning supply chain, a functioning in many states, that Mexico want, when you're passing a federal law, you don't want to follow someone else's federal law that may not work. Like you said, for a population that's 60% against it still from an adult use, from a medical population that's barely touched the plant, from a stigmatic element, right? The Catholic Church was not for adult use and just recently supported medical. So I think Mexico has a lot of work to do to build education that the United States doesn't. And I think they wanted to do that at their own pace rather than say, oh, the United States legalized. And then also, look, whenever you can get in front of the United States on anything, you don't look like the tail, you know, it doesn't feel as much as like they just did it in reaction to us. And I think that may get them more buy-in and earn them credibility with their populace.
So another thing that I knew that you had been thinking about it because I know how your mind works and it's awesome. Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I was also wondering if maybe, I mean, what we've seen through the data, right, is that the demand continues to explode. And, you know, so there may be this idea of, if they can get their act together before we become federal legal in the United States, they might also have an opportunity to help meet the explosion of demand. If
well, exportation.
Have to set up.
Yeah, biomass, right. Exportation, yeah. Industrial hemp. Yeah, there's probably a lot of elements of that. But remember, I mean, you're not, the federal illegality here, which, you know, you and I have probably spoken about 5,000 times, does create this unique element where the United States, it's not, I always, you know, kind of, I would say I'm a little bit harsh on people who draw the analogy to alcohol because alcohol was only illegal in the United States. And so the United States had built this incredibly illegal importation, you know, very sophisticated importation from ships, you know, watch the show Boardwalk Empire. There's, you know, stuff from Canadian routes to shipping to, that's not gonna, you know, Mexico, I think, didn't want to deal with that. And so in their mind, like, think, can you imagine a massive exportation business from California into Mexico? I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense if I was...
No, the other way around.
Right, no,
I would think the other way
around.
Right,
right. But I'm saying, you know, that's why I think you have to get in front of the United States if you're Mexico, because you would then be kind of subject, you know, the United States does influence things. And I think, you know, just to make a broad point, which, well, actually, I don't want to get in front of Abby's kind of agenda, but New York is a good example. When the financial center of the world, or the financial center of the United States, at least, passes a law, it touches financial people. Then the stigma goes away from there. The, you know, the nose in the air, like, oh, cannabis. When that starts to go down, and I think Mexico had a chance to stamp their own, you know, their own expression of what cannabis should be. And it's a pretty thoughtful law. It's incredibly thoughtful for a country that had 8% support in 2016 for a legalization. And that's remarkable.
That really is. And so I do want to come back to the New York market because I know that that's literally your backyard. Yeah. So for in regards to Mexico, so both Canada and Mexico will have legalized recreational cannabis. So how do you think this will impact the legal cannabis movement's momentum in North America, so the United States that's left?
Well, it's interesting. I don't want to say it won't impact it, because it should. Obviously, when it's easier for a regulator to say, look, our southern neighbors have now passed it. Our northern neighbors have had it since October 17th, 2017 or 18. And what are we doing? You know, so it's more of a, let's call it a momentum driver. But I think the United States, legalization is not, it is absolutely a fundamentally important thing. But a SAFE Act solves a problem, because the supply chain in the United States already intact, right? I federalization of cannabis is not going to occur. It's going to be a state-by-state game for a long time. So I think that the normalization of cannabis is going to come before the legalization in the United States, because it's already here in some ways. So in Mexico, you need the legalization to drive normalization. United States is the only place in the world, because of our federalist system, right? States have their own ability to pass things and move them forward. So I think the United States moves at its own pace still. And so I just don't, it's not that it's not impactful, but I do think people sometimes, like, for the soundbite, oh my God, this is the most important thing, and the United States is going to pass tomorrow. It's just, I mean, I try to be real and more nuanced about it. The federal legalization of cannabis in the United States is important, no doubt. It is not the most important thing occurring on the ground in cannabis right now in the United States, right? It is the people who are doing it on the state-based level, the growth, who are building the CAGR, you know, the new frontier chart of how much illegal activity there still is. Still a massive market, Giada. You are the one who, you know, originally kind of wanted to draw that distinction with how big the illegal market is versus the legal market. And so I just think that a federal legalization tomorrow does not make the cannibalization of the illicit market go faster. It really doesn't. In one day, it's going to take a year or two for that federal legalization to occur. But medical research will go on, capital efficiency, access to capital, cheaper capital, all those things will drive cannabis businesses forward. But what's happening at the state level is really what's driving it. And I don't think Mexico, if you're a regulator in Alabama who has, you know, who hasn't even passed a real medical law yet, it can help you say, look at what Mexico's done. We're now behind Mexico. Not to be culturally make some cultural comparison, but that is what happens, right? The UN removing it from its list of prescribed substances definitely helped Mexico get this legalization in place.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, another point that your intrepid John made to me, you know, which is an important point about the UN.
So speaking of the UN and then on the international arena. So one of the things that I think about is, so what we're beginning to see sort of, and I mentioned this actually at the Mexico Cannabis Summit, we're beginning to see what appears to be the emergence of centers of excellence across regions, right? Which is a really interesting dynamic, because the cannabis industry is it's an emerging market, but it's an emerging market that's emerging on a global scale all at once. So instead of, you know, so it's dynamic are now truly across the globe, and you're beginning to see sort of, again, continents or regions begin to sort of try to focus on certain areas. Of course, along with that, you have this trading and import-export, this interaction with countries and across regions. If that continues to evolve the way it seems to be evolving now, where you see sort of Africa and Latin America kind of competing for that sort of, you know, cultivation hub with potentially lower labor costs and therefore better wholesale pricing and therefore exporting. And then you're beginning to see the emergence of Asia Pacific, specifically Australia, New Zealand, and that area sort of really trying to push forward the medical pharmaceutical research from a very, very intense, very sophisticated, very, very interesting new research beyond what anyone else is doing. Then you continue to have North America as the epicenter of consumption, but also let's not forget that we do have some pretty amazing technology and innovation that is occurring in cannabis in North America, specifically in the United States, that is now being also used, utilized, and adopted elsewhere, right? Specifically, let's think about processing, which is lacking in other areas. And then you have Europe, where Europe seems to sort of trying to figure out what's going to happen. They've got some pretty solid consumption. They're probably going to end up being a net importer because there's not really that much more land to cultivate. And there certainly seemed to be an angle from the food and beverage and health and beauty perspective in terms of they could become sort of that epicenter of consumer packaged goods then get exported. I'm painting this picture because what's clear about all of this is there's going to be import-export. And I haven't even touched China and India with hemp. Okay, so I'm not even going to go there yet.
And they already have a huge cultural belief in that. By the way, I just want to point out how amazing your point is about the U.S. being the epicenter of this illegal innovation early on, right? That pioneering ethos that we always talk about. I mean, California, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, they literally 90% of the technology that's been innovated with product forms comes from a real legacy illegality that other, I don't think other countries have that same cowboy mentality, because California really turned its eyes away from it for 20 years and just let it occur in this like quasi gray space. That's an amazing point you're making, is like the United States is still the innovation center of cannabis.
By far. Indeed. Yeah. But going back to that global, so the impact of, you know, what's going to happen, you know, how does Canada and Mexico legalizing affect our legalization in the United States, what could be the impact of not getting that, you know, crossing that federal legalization line? My fear is that with the emergence of these centers of excellence and this massive global trading system that is sort of we're seeing evolve, if we don't come up with a true federal structure, we're going to be left behind with this incredible high quality sort of, you know, cultivation, seeds, et cetera, and also all this technology and the inability to play with others on a global scale. Now, that's not 100% true, because there's obviously still some trading going on. But the question is, would it put us behind sort of the eight ball in relative to other nations, especially Mexico and Canada, both big nations, or China and India and Australia?
How would you set an industrial trade in the United global States? If you don't have a federal regime, how do you settle a trade, right? How do you get to a commodification of cannabis or hemp? Yeah, I agree with you.
So that's a big question.
Excellent point.
Yeah, it's a great
one. Both of you have made excellent points. I should be taking notes as we're talking. But speaking of the United States, let's just focus to what again is your home state, Mitch, and talk about the New York market. So according to a recent article in The Guardian, New York is poised to join the growing number of states that have legalized the recreational use and sale of cannabis. The legislation would allow for recreational sales, licensing for delivery of cannabis products, and allow individual New Yorkers to grow cannabis for personal consumption. So Cuomo's administration has estimated legalization could eventually bring the state $350 million annually. Mitch, do you have any predictions or expectations for a legal New York market?
Well, I think it's a fait accompli at this point for a variety of factors, but it's done from what I understand. And it's actually not awful. I don't love the THC-based taxation. I think they'll probably have to tweak that a little bit, because it has like a fixed cost and then a 9% and then a local tax. And I think that the state may want to rethink taxing on a THC basis. You know, it's just going to be very complicated, require an incredible amount of product specific accounting, which I think is going to be in a massive burden for the small operator, right? Who doesn't have, you know, it's like 0.9, it's like 9 bips per gram of THC. I don't think it's an ideal way to do it. I think there's a reason why other states have not done it. So it's interesting to do it that way. I think New York is the financial capital of the United States. I think that the most interesting element of it is that New York had a medical regime that was so constrained and restrictive that you didn't really have the buy-in at the New York sort of patient level, consumer level. And I think New York is probably a $6 billion. I mean, Giada can probably say it better than I, but it's
$10 billion in the next 4 years is what we're estimating.
Let's call it 2 to 3. So let's say that 50, if they can get to a level where they're just California levels of fulfillment, you're talking about a $3 billion legal market by the end of 22, 23. So
that's exactly what we got.
Huge market. I think it will generate a lot more taxes. You know, like what we've seen is when you legalize, you not just get the illicit market cannibalization, you do get kind of a step function gain in the new consumer as well. And I think that's kind of an intriguing thing to see, because, you know, there was recently an article in Forbes where the argument was like the illegal market's not going anywhere. Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's not going anywhere day one, but over time, what ends up happening is the choice, the access, the quality, and the safety are so much superior in the legal market. And if you look at the operators that are currently there, Curaleaf, Cresco, GTI, Ianthus, Vireo, Columbia Care, I might be forgetting one or two. There's one private one. When you look at those operators, these are people that have succeeded in tough markets, who have built great product sets, who will be, you know, day one, the New York market is going to have phenomenal products. And unlike California, that kind of stumbled its way into legality through rule changes, when you get such a robust process to pass the law, you've really fleshed out a lot of the issues that can pop up. So it's going to, I think it's done, and it's going to be, the implementation is going to be interesting. I think, you know, setting up the Office of Cannabis Management will definitely improve. Whenever you have a dedicated regulator, right, you're going to get better responsiveness. That's what COVID kind of drove home to people, is those regulators, the states that had regulators that were devoted, you know, not the Department of Health guy who lost the coin flip to regulate in cannabis. When you have dedicated regulators, you get a better program because those regulators understand their program's needs better.
Yeah. And you mentioned that COVID, do you think, since one of the provisions with the adult use legalization there was delivery, I know in a past episode, the importance of delivery to compete with the illicit market was addressed specifically for New York. Do you think that COVID had any impact on that for including that as a provision at all?
No, I think delivery, from what I understand in the process, I think delivery is seen as a fairly easy way to include a lot of social equity applicants who, because it's fulfillment and it's a like a capital light part of the business. Although I think regulators are going to realize that, when you talk about menuing and how tech has really intervened in delivery, that it's much more complicated than just someone picking it up and delivering it, you know, point to point. That if I was a large wholesaler or a large retailer, I would want a fairly sophisticated delivery, so I get, you know, real time checkups on locations, so I can, you know, stay apprised of what's going on, so that when people complain, the customer service might be handled, but obviously someone's going to hold the person they bought it from. They're not going to care about that it was a third party delivering it. So I think third party delivery can be somewhat challenging. And, you know, when you look at companies that have done, Driven is one example, or Ease, you know, large delivery companies, technology is a huge element of it and doing it well. I mean, doing it well and doing it at scale. And so I think New York, the delivery element, it feels to me like that's kind of low hanging fruit for engaging people on lower capital requirements, things that are maybe more simple, but I think they're going to learn over time that the expectations, this is a much more sophisticated industry now. And I think the expectations of a retailer or a wholesaler or patients or consumers for that matter is so much higher that there's a huge tech element and a huge real-time day of delivery. You know, you look at like what Trulieve's done in Florida or other large companies that aren't necessarily in New York right now. And it's a sophisticated business on the delivery side. Fulfillment is way more complicated now than it used to be. So I think regulators are going to want to think about that. But COVID has changed curbside delivery. Yes, it has made it easier across the country to get those things written into law. There's definitely behavioral changes in cannabis from COVID that are permanent.
New York is going to present the opportunity. I call it the Fifth Avenue of cannabis. I mean, in essence, that's what, you know, think, you know, the Fifth Avenue cannabis, like all of the best brands are going to be basically selling the products there to the financial centers of the United States, arguably one of the financial centers of the Western world and a massive touristic city. So you can expect basically the best of the best, right? You're going to go get your Louis Vuitton of cannabis. So
one of the brands, you know, Her Highness, you know, is talking about creating a flagship store that has like this Saks Fifth Avenue stylistic element. And I think you're going to see a lot of brands want to put there, just like you said it best. I think you're going to find brands really gravitating to New York, just like they gravitate, you know, LA. The interesting thing, they didn't have to gravitate to LA. Right. Everyone's already in California. So I think, you know, a lot of great brand. California is definitely the brand launching capital of the world. And now those brands can kind of gravitate to their East Coast cousin.
There's a reason why Fashion Week and those things are in New York. It's from an international perspective, there is no better platform as a U.S. brand than being able to exhibit in New York. So your exposure is just massive on a global scale, and you're expected to be the best of the best if you made it there. So there's just so many interesting variables in terms of this New York market. And I do call it the Fifth Avenue of cannabis. I can't wait. I can't wait to go and shop.
It's going to be interesting. Yeah.
Definitely will be interesting for like cannabis tourism, but I know that that's something that came up with New Jersey's decision to legalize recreational cannabis. So, and that's, we've discussed like New York at that point in time as well. So for other states that are neighbor New York that are considering legalization, Giada, just how significant is this recent announcement from New York for those surrounding states?
Well, you mentioned this, the reciprocity and all those elements will come into play in terms of to see how that, you know, the market, how the demand and supply will shift back and forth. At the end of the, I mean, going back to this element, this Fifth Avenue of cannabis, I think the it may create some heavier competition in terms of the quality and the diversity expected. So those are two things that operators are probably going to have to start thinking about now, because the consumer is, I mean, now we're in, you know, times of COVID, there's not a lot of, you know, movement, but that's going to change. It's temporary. Once the doors open up, if movement goes back, those are the tri-state areas. There's a lot of movement back and forth. So the consumer is going to have a lot of choices and ability to sort of weigh cost versus quality versus brand versus experience, you name it. So I think it's definitely going to put some pressure on the brands and the operators to make sure that they really understand what differentiates their product.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who, from a tourism perspective, that, you know, we're dry in New York, that if they enjoy it and they can get it here while they're here, they're just like LA, there's going to be a fairly large tourism part, which is why you can't, when you quantify, I think one of the challenges for you guys to quantify, like what the illicit market looks like in New York, you're judging it based on the demographics of New York. It's hard to quantify how much itinerant tourist use there is, because And as stigmas drop, and if you can get in Times Square and then go take a picture with Spider-Man and King Kong or whatever the heck people do, you know, I think people are, who knows, you know, the naked cowboy may have to, you know, he may become something different. You know, he may become the naked marijuana leaf or something like that. But, you know, I think that you're just going to get a lot of different, legalizing it changes. There's the culture and artistic elements of cannabis haven't really been fully explored, because it still has this sense of like, you can't be fully the full expression of what you want to do where it's illegal. So if you're a New Yorker, you haven't been able, people who have ideas around art or around culture or around building a store haven't had a chance to participate at all, other than if they were part of a medical licensee. And so I think what you're going to watch is a total hyperspeed unlocking of entrepreneurial spirit. That's going to be interesting. And I think, because people from LA and New York kind of share that very large municipal, you know, that sort of urban ethos, you're going to find, just like Chicago has been a hub. And I think you're going to, now you have, you know, the three elements, East Coast, Midwest and West Coast, all legal. And I think there's going to be an unlocking of incredible entrepreneurial spirit. And it's exciting to be on the ground finally in one of these legalizations with respect to where I live, right? I've been traveling for 8 or 9 years, and I felt like a paratrooper, and now I finally get to land on my own shores.
Indeed, you are certainly front row seats, Mr. Berokowitz. Front row seats.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is certainly very exciting. And so I guess before we wrap up, Mitch, are there any final thoughts you'd like to share? And then I'll turn it to Giada for it to share any final thoughts or words, whether that's on Mexico or New York, or just what you'll be keeping your eye on in Q2 of this year.
Yeah, I think if you look at just the broader cannabis space in general, the earnings from last quarter were all, you know, for the larger guys, were all pretty spectacular. And I think when you look at like a New York legalization, a Mexico legalization, where a lot of, I'm sure there will be, especially for California-based companies, a real opportunity to participate and partner. I think you just look at how large the growth factor of cannabis can be over the next 3-5 years. And a lot of people, you know, if you would have asked me in 2013, how many years is this hypergrowth going to be? I might have said a couple of years, maybe 5, maybe 6. And now here we are 7, 8 years later, and it's still exploding. And I think what I've been surprised by and what I'm really intrigued to see in Mexico is what happens when you get another federal legalization at this level. But unlike Canada, which had a really robust sort of culture for illegal cannabis usage, right? Like BC Bud was, everyone in college knew about it. It was kind of like the joke, right? That something from Canada, like, get ready, the good stuff's coming. And I think it's going to be interesting to watch a country start from scratch and watch how American companies participate and how everyone who thinks they can fairly judge the total addressable market of cannabis are, they've missed the mark on the low side every time. They're going to continue to miss on the low side for at least a few more years. And that the opportunity is really just starting. It's there's really so much more room in, you know, New York, and the innovation may lead to more form factors. And obviously the closer we get to a federal legalization and that unlocking of the medical research. We saw there was an article recently about Raphael Mishulam and how he's using synthetics for cannabis acids, which are quite fragile bonds that you only can do synthetically. We haven't gotten to cannabis-based medicines yet. We haven't even talked about reimbursement, which, you know, New York in early March mandated workers' comp reimbursement, joining New Jersey and Maine and New Mexico and other states that have done this already. Wait until you get insurance reimbursement. That is the beginning of the next sort of really big run for cannabis from a new consumption perspective. And, you know, I know New Frontiers on top of the data. I know I use you guys' data nonstop. And I'm so thankful that I get to wake up every day and do something that can do such good for society and can be managed and can be controlled and doesn't have this, you know, this real, really big negative. Obviously there's always negatives if you overconsume or if their addiction is an issue, and we have to deal with that as a society, as a medical issue. But I'd much rather see people paying attention to cannabis than opioids or, you know, or overconsuming other drugs. You know, I don't think of cannabis, I think it's a natural plant. And so watching Mexico, which had a huge stigma against this, move forward is a very, very encouraging thing for society and for the economic opportunity of cannabis companies.
Well said. It is certainly a turning point. So I'm going to go back to, so I'm calling here from Italy, as you said, bandwidth and connectivity. Fortunately, not the best in the south of Italy. Great shoreline and mountains, but not good connectivity.
Can't have it all. Can't have good internet in a beautiful country. Yeah.
Apparently not. Still waiting. Apparently not.
Right.
But it certainly gives, you know, it's a little bit of a, it's interesting to sort of look at what's happening from here. If you think about it, what happened, so European Union already is took a stand. We have the World Health Organization, United Nations. Now we have another third of the most populous nations in the world going, legalizing, and in this case, federally. I think that one of the things that we can expect is a lot more countries announcing, entering, or participating in legalization or decriminalization in some shape or form. I certainly expect a lot of nations here in Europe to follow suit because they're watching and they're very interested. I mean, being here representing New Frontier Data, I'm getting a lot of calls from European, from folks from all over Europe. And I mean, all over Europe, Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Central Europe, you name it. Very interested in understanding how can, you know, what does it mean to legalize? What does it mean to decriminalize? How can they participate in the North American market, even from here? So I think it's definitely one more underline for the global spectators that are looking at what's happening and wanting and sort of one more hook to have, you know, that's going to make them want to enter it and be part of it in one way or another. So certainly another catalyst to the continued globalization of cannabis.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like the growth and continued expansion of the global cannabis industry certainly does not have any plans on slowing down for the rest of 2021. If you want to stay up to speed and gain access to vetted, actionable insights into the legal cannabis industry, don't miss out on the new Equio experience launching the week of April 5th. To learn more and get started with a free 7-day trial, visit equio.io. That's equio.io. Mitch, Giada, thank you both for your time and for a wonderful conversation today.
And as always, thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us at Cano Week. I'm your host, Abby Kaufman, and I'll see you next week.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.